What's up and welcome to Progressive Opinions of Color. This is a podcast that seeks to create space for people of color and other underrepresented voices in conversations about politics and economics. My name is Nancy Wu. I'm your host. And today we have a special guest, my friend Nina Lee Coombs. She is a brilliant writer who is based in Chicago, and she has words in The Atlantic, in Narratively, in Catapult, among many others. And we have a lot to talk about. We are both immigrants to the U.S., and as a biracial Japanese American, Nina talks about moving to the U.S. from Japan as a child. I was also born in China, and my family moved to the U.S. when I was six, so we'll share some stories about childhood and assimilation slash racism that we faced and just growing up in the U.S. We'll also talk a bit about what patriotism is, what defines citizenship, and national borders. And finally, Nina has some book recs that she will recommend by some Asian American authors. So I'll link everything below, and be sure to subscribe, rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts. It really helps me out as a new podcaster. And now we have a website, so make sure to check that out in the show notes. It's going to be nancyfwu.com. And then check us out on Instagram at POC Podcast and Twitter at Opinions POC. So yeah, Twitter already took up POC Podcast. Unfortunately, it is so hard to get all the handles. I feel like if you didn't start your podcast or your brand in the time when the internet was formed, then like all your handles got taken. So whatever, it is what it is. I got all the show notes down there for y'all. So let's get started and dive into the conversation. Oh my God. I'm always so fucking awkward when I do this because I have like my normal voice and then I have my podcast voice that like I can successfully do for like 2 seconds before I forget about it. So, but it's like that transition is like, hello everyone and welcome to the podcast episode. Today I have Nina and she is a brilliant writer who I met at a Tin House workshop right before the quarantine started and we like just made it. So I have her today. We're going to have a lot of things to talk about. So I'm excited. And Nina, how are you? Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, it's great to be on the podcast. I'm Nina Lee Coombs. I'm a Japanese American writer. Before I was a writer, I worked as a television news producer in New York. And then, so basically my current writing love is nonfiction, but I also love to dabble in fiction and just really excited to be here and talking with you post Tin House. And if people don't know what Tin House is, that's a writing workshop in Oregon.
Talk more about your writing a little bit, because I know you're like publishing in The Atlantic all the time and like Narratively and like badass publications. So how did you get started in writing?
Yeah, for sure. So my initial writing background, the thing that got me started like when I was really young, I was a part of Louder Than a Bomb, which is the world's largest youth poetry slam. It's held in Chicago every year. And I did that primarily because my mother told me that I couldn't be in the school musicals anymore. So I wanted like a different performance outlet. And so I wrote poetry for a long time, wrote poetry through college, and thought that was my primary mode of writing. And then I went to New York and worked in television and started kind of delving into this world of like more documentary nonfiction settings, and began writing nonfiction. After working as a television producer, I worked as a research assistant, which was great because it gave me a lot of time when there weren't many research projects. And so then I started pitching places, and discovered that I really like the thrill of sort of putting myself out there for editors and oftentimes getting rejected, but sometimes getting accepted. So I've been doing that ever since.
Oh my gosh. These are goals because I like really admire that like you like are always writing things and like I'm always seeing you getting published somewhere and it's always like that is such a daunting process. I can't even imagine. I don't think I've ever tried to like finish anything I've written before. What projects have you been working on lately? What have you been thinking about in your writing? What have you been excited about?
In terms of something that I published recently that I'm very happy about, I write regularly for the Chicago Reader, which is one of the free papers in Chicago. It's one of, I think they used to be owned or in partnership with the Chicago Sun-Times, but as of last year or the year before that, broke off and are now independent. And so usually I write their film capsules, which are not credited. I just write the like 150 word blurb about what a movie is about. But last week for their education issue, I wrote like 1,000 word essay about being a student of Chicago public schools. So my family moved to Chicago when I was in middle school, when I started sixth grade. And we went to our neighborhood Chicago public school, and that experience basically changed my life. And I get really fed up with usually conservative pundits and conservative parents and people talking about how poor the state of public education is. And often what they're saying is true, but there are so many intangible benefits to going to a public school that I'm being biased here, but I really sincerely doubt that a private school can deliver as well or as naturally. So I wrote that. I wrote an ode to a Chicago public school education in the Reader, which I'm very happy about. And otherwise, I've been toying with this thought puzzle about patriotism, writing and researching about it, but that's not something that's a finished product as of now.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. I have so many like follow-ups to that. First, I'm curious about the school part, because in your immigration story and like Chicago and everything, basically, I think I messaged you on Instagram that I was like interested in all of those things. But I was just talking to another friend, Nicole, who's also going to be on a podcast episode probably next week, about how she grew up in New York City and went to public school, but it was kind of like applying for college, where New Yorkers just like have to apply to different public schools if they want to go to a good one. And then I went to like a pretty like average public school in California, where like not many people really go out of state afterwards for college, let alone go to college that much. So I'm curious like about the pros of the public school system, especially in Chicago. I don't know anything about private schools except that like I met some like bougie ass people in college who I don't really like that much. That's about it. And like they taught me what privilege was, like in a way that is beyond my comprehension. But in terms of like the benefits of public school, like let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. So I have been in many school systems. I spent the first 7 years of my life in Japan. And while I was there, I went to a kindergarten, which was a private kindergarten. And then I went to a public elementary school, Japanese public school system. And then we moved to the U.S. and I went to a public school in rural Illinois, which was a very particular, very white experience. And then we moved to Chicago in 2004, 2005, and I started attending a neighborhood middle school, Mary Gage Peterson School in Albany Park. And that is, like you were talking about, really regular. There's not any testing or anything to get in. It's just a neighborhood school. If you live in the zip code, you get to go there. And what that basically meant was that it was very, very diverse in terms of ethnic and racial backgrounds, as well as backgrounds of class and like jobs and people who were documented and undocumented. And so when I was about 11, however old people are in sixth grade, you know, my life went from trying to survive this like very white American public school system in rural Illinois to this incredibly diverse, most people are English as second language speakers, middle school. And that really sort of saved me from the kind of emotional difficulties and sort of racist structures of the rural public school system. I then had an experience similar to what it sounds like your friend in New York did for high school. So in the Chicago public school system for high school, there are regular neighborhood schools, which you can just go with your zip code. And then there are lottery schools, which are like you apply to get in. It's not a very rigorous application, but it's based on a lottery system. And then there are magnet and selective enrollment schools, which are schools that you have to test into. And it's basically like applying to college, but you're 13 when you do it. So I did that and I went, it was incredibly stressful. You know, they like tally your extracurriculars and your zip code, and there's like racial quotas and affirmative action on like a 13-year-old level. It was quite the thing. But I went to a selective enrollment school. I went to Northside College Prep for high school. And that was its own experience. It was still pretty diverse, but it was very, very high stress and very self-selective. So I would say when I think about like public school and how much I loved it, I'm very specifically talking about the 3 years of middle school. Although, you know, high school was fine, I guess.
How is that? How would that be like if, for example, if you moved to the US or moved to Chicago and like in middle school and like we're still learning English or something? I know, like, for myself, I moved to the US when I was 6, but I like was just a slacker and was too scared to speak up in any English classes and like just got D's on my report cards until like throughout like half of middle school. So my middle school GPA would have been fucked, like, if I had to apply to high schools like that. And that would not have been very fair.
No, I mean, so I also had like, I was in an ESL class when I first got here. Definitely had language difficulties upon arrival and like still have weird translation blip moments. But I think what you're saying is picking up on like how unfair the system is. I know that a few years ago there was a scandal in Chicago because it turned out that like white parents were buying empty lots in South Side neighborhoods. So the Chicago is very segregated. The North Side is largely white. And the South Side of Chicago is Black, and, you know, resources in the city sort of run along those lines. And so what these white parents were doing is they had houses on the North Side, but were buying empty lots on the South Side and claiming that their address was there. So their kids would get picked up in the zip code quotas. And so that they could, these white kids who don't live on the South Side could go to selective enrollment schools. Yeah, it's a totally fucked up unfair system.
Did you, like, when you're growing up in Chicago and, like, even in, like, especially rural Illinois, like, what the hell is that? Like, what was some, like, culture shock moments? Like, how was your, like, experience growing up there?
Yeah, rural Illinois, definitely culture shock. So, for background, my mother is from Nagoya, which is a central kind of industrial city in Japan. And my dad is from Lombard, which is a small town outside of Chicago, which is to say he's white. My mom is Japanese. So when we, and Japan is also like a really, it's a country that exists on a mono ethnicity myth, like a monoracial myth. So even living in Japan as like a half white child, as a mixed race child, there was a lot of like bullying and difficulty with peers and strange things expected or said to me by adults. So I think I had this very naive idea that if I moved to the States, I would be an American and people would accept me. And then we moved to rural Illinois where everyone was white. And I remember having this really long, like months long fight with this girl in one of my classes about how Japan was not China. But, you know, very quickly found, yeah, that was not, it was not going to be immediate acceptance. Like, these people also were very monoracial and had their own barriers and their own cruelties. Yeah, I mean, like, there were super small culture shocks. Like, rural Illinois runs on well water, so whenever we would try to make rice, the rice would turn yellow.
Oh, shit. That's so weird.
It was really weird and gross. And then there's like larger things like bullying based on appearance, or another weird argument I got into with a girl on the school bus about how Sailor Moon, she was convinced that Sailor Moon was made in America. And I was like, it's not made in America. And she was like, if it's this good, it has to be from the USA. Yeah.
Oh my God. What the hell? These people are like straight up arguing like Japan is China is not. Oh my God. I can't. The audacity of like, I can't even. I'm like speechless. Yeah. Childhood. Good times. Good times to be an immigrant.
Yeah. I mean, I think all the time about essay that you submitted for Tin House, and that moment where you wore the Playboy Bunny sweatshirt to school, and like that awkwardness, that like not knowing, yeah, that definitely spoke to me.
Oh yeah. For context for our listeners, it was like when I was a kid, I came from China, and my grandpa got me this bright yellow puffer jacket, and like Playboy is a brand in China, and there's like this huge like like black or silver, like sequin, like embellished rhinestone, whatever, like shiny Playboy logo just on the back. And I like wore that to school. I mean, that's like a pretty dope jacket if I think about it. And then, yeah. Like the teacher was like, you can't wear that ever again. So then I went home and I didn't understand like why I couldn't wear it. And I told my mom, like, yeah, I don't think Americans are like allowed to wear yellow to school. I was like, I don't get it. And then I think later I realized that Playboy is, I don't even know what Playboy is.
Adult magazine, maybe? Who knows?
Yeah, something like that. Weird things. It is an experience. Like, how do you think, like, growing up, immigrating and living in different places and growing up biracially has influenced, like, your, both your political beliefs and, like, your writing?
Yeah. In terms of my writing, I think it is a huge impact. And in some way, I think all of my writing is just trying to understand and translate what it means to go through spaces and be other, or go through spaces and find yourself at a loss or by yourself. I am working on some fiction, which has to do with like Asian people in rural America. That's definitely trying to reinterpret, understand what it was that happened when we first got to this, my sister and my mother and I encountered like the expanse of white America for the first time. Politically speaking, I really feel like I have experienced a real breadth of political opinion and reality. I was talking to my dad the other day about the upcoming elections, and I was saying how I remembered the first election that ever happened. So it was like a midterm election when we first moved here, and we were living still in rural Illinois. And my dad at the time was the only member of our family who could vote. And so he went to the polling place, and there was a man with a rifle outside of the polling place checking if people were Republicans. And my dad, who was not going to vote Republican, lied and said he was so he could get in. But that's sort of the political climate that I first came to America and experienced. Yeah, I definitely have, you know, it runs the gamut from like my great grandfather was like a proto-communist in Japan, to seeing like very conservative Japanese politicians take power now, to the conservative rural American life, to the Democratic Socialist Party in Chicago.
So like recently you've been like really involved with like activism. I remember seeing you like posting these like translations.
I am involved in organizing and activism in Chicago insofar as I support it as I can. I say that because some of my close friends are like among the most active organizers in Chicago. And so since they're close to me, like I see what they're doing and know that what I'm doing is like the bare minimum. The thing that I was doing during the George Floyd moment was Black Lives Matter Chicago chapter had a very specific set of 10 demands that they were bringing to the mayor. And I was sort of in conversations with my mom, who's primarily a Japanese speaker and lives in Chicago, realized that there were some like gaps in how the protests were being conveyed to people who didn't speak English as sort of these like giant outbursts of emotion with no real end goal. And had the idea that maybe in Chicago's multiple ethnic enclaves in these neighborhoods, it would be good to be able to have some sort of signage that was in the language of the people who lived there so they could know why it was that people were taking to the streets and what it was that they were asking for. Or even just to know that, for example, like in Chicago, there was an ordinance that tried, and I don't think it passed, but that tried to make it a like hate speech or a hate crime to like prevent people from Blue Lives Matter type discussion. And so the Black Lives Matter Chicago chapter was calling for that to end. They were also calling for like reparations for victims of police torture in Chicago and the closing of a black box site, which is where the police still have it open, where black people were disappeared to. So there's just like a lot that was happening in the city that I felt like there wasn't adequate language access to. But since then, I feel like since that initial burst, my work has just been like support, donation.
Translation thing is pretty badass because like I saw like one, there was like one thing going around where people translated to a lot of languages, and like that was the only resource out there that I showed my dad, and he read it and he shared it with all his friends. And that was like the one time we got to be a little bit on the same page about things because there wasn't a language barrier there.
Do you generally try to have those political conversations in Chinese as opposed to English?
I only speak to my parents in Chinese. Mm-hmm. Like I'll use Chinglish, I guess, sometimes.
Yeah.
For some words, but I grew up speaking to them in Chinese, and I think my Chinese is better. My Chinese is better than their English. So it's easier to communicate that way. But and I also try to call them out like every time they say something. And I'm getting like slightly better at finding the language in Chinese for those conversations, but still frustrating. Is there a language barrier with you and your mom? Like, or your Japanese is like pretty fluent too, right?
I think that my mom's English is probably better than my Japanese. She's capable of carrying on a political conversation in English, probably more than I am capable of carrying it on in Japanese to her. But I find that our conversations about politics, when I'm trying to appeal to her sense of empathy or compassion, those tend to go better when they're in Japanese. So we were talking, we were on a walk the other day, and we were talking about like the police brutality, police murder protests. And I was trying to explain to her the sort of history of US policing based in like British constabulary practices, as well as like post Jim Crow continuations of slave catching and enslaved like practices to keep enslavement alive, basically. And then I was trying to explain bail to her in English, and that wasn't really getting through. And then I switched to Japanese, and she had this moment where it was like, wow, that's completely messed up. So, you know, it's a kind of bilingual give and take. My current thing is I'm trying to get her to understand why she should boycott Amazon, but that one is not going as well for me.
So you mentioned that you were thinking about patriotism a lot.
Yeah.
What have you been thinking about?
So I have been thinking about patriotism for a couple of reasons. When the pandemic kicked off and then we went into this protest moment, I was thinking about people who would call the protesters un-American and then other people who would say it was American. And at that time, I was reading some James Baldwin, and he has a very famous quote where he talks about it isn't that he hates America, it's that he loves her, and that's why he criticizes her. And I was thinking about this notion of loving America, which is obviously the notion of patriotism and what it means, what it gives us. And then I also read this book, which I have been thinking about a lot, called Imagine Communities by Benedict Anderson. I don't know if you've read that, but it's a book of like political literary theory. And the main premise is that nations didn't always exist. And in fact, came about because of various reasons, sort of around the Enlightenment, and that basically nations are imagined and they're imaginary. And so all these things culminated to me wondering about like, what good is patriotism? What is the use of demanding love from citizens? Especially given that a nation cannot feasibly love a citizen back. That's a completely unilateral demand. And then what is the function of that? And at this point, my like cynical conclusion is that patriotism is a way to like manipulate the masses into self-sacrificial behavior and not expecting any sort of return from the state when the state should just be a pragmatic system that either delivers or does not. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, there's this herd behavior associated with it where patriotism is seen as a good thing. But first of all, like, what is the purpose? And second of all, what harm does it do to have that kind of mindset? Because just like loving a country because you were born there or because it's your country and you happen to live there, having patriotism in the U.S. comes with so many things like excluding immigrants and like defining a country by its borders. Like, that is part of what a country even is. And like, who can be an American? Who can call this country ours and who do we have to exclude in that process? And when there are limited resources in the world, and like you have to drill for oil in other places, like who are you harming? There's no way to just like love a country just because it belongs to yours, and also like think that you care about the world.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of COVID, my mom, who is Asian and is like, she's Japanese, but in the context of like random people racing her on the street, they're just like, oh, Asian, right? Like they're not thinking about which Asian is she. And my mom was spouting off all this like pro-Japanese nationalist nonsense about Japanese people being like superior in their COVID response and they're not going to experience racism at the hands of the American, blah, blah, blah. And so I had to be like, do you know what yellow peril is? Did you know that like the language that like Asians are like an infestation of bugs that you can kill as many as you want, they still spring up? Like people thought that about Japanese people too. Like your nationalism isn't, your like patriotism, I should say rather, because it's not nationalism, is harming you. You're being ignorant to the way in which you can have solidarity with other people. I think what you're saying and what I'm picking up on also, which I think is so interesting, is the way that patriotism often is a zero-sum game. If you love one country, you can't love another. And which I think people like you or I or anyone who's immigrated or called any other place home know intrinsically that like that isn't true. You can love multiple places. And now I feel like I'm advocating for like national polyamory, but you know,
or dual citizenship.
Well, yeah. So I think that's another reason why I've been thinking a lot about this and feel particularly sensitive to it, is because I'm a dual citizen of the United States and Japan, which is illegal in Japan. So Japan asks that you choose a nation after a certain age. And that is something, it has made me someone who's very, very hyper aware and hypersensitive of what does a country mean when someone is a citizen? Like, how is citizenship awarded? When is it taken away? How can you prove that you're a citizen? And so if you start questioning the boundaries of citizenship and the foundations of citizenship, the foundations of patriotism also start to look really suspect. Yeah. Are you dual citizen?
No, I can't be a Chinese citizen and a US citizen. So my parents and I like got our green card maybe like when I was 10. So fairly like soon after we came to the US, but we didn't get citizenship. We didn't apply for citizenship until I was in college. So like, I think when I was 19. And we could have gotten it much earlier, but because we were so loyal to China, we didn't want to give up our citizenship. That was a big emotional process.
Yeah.
So it took a while, and then we eventually did it because, like, I don't know, we just figured like it was time. Like there was, we could still get like a 10-year visa and go to China, but like we couldn't go to North Korea or Russia anymore. So whatever. Politically speaking, well, it wasn't like it was beneficial to have U.S. citizenship. It was definitely a process, and I think about this all the time. Like, because since COVID happened, like we can't go back to China, and with Trump being like, if Trump is elected again, or with all these tensions here, who knows when we can go back to China again? Like, I used to take it for granted that we could go back every year, and it's weird because like whenever we arrive in the airport at immigration in China, the immigration officers, like even though they see our U.S. passports, they speak to us in Chinese, like they in Mandarin, like they can see that we are. And they asked me to write my name in Chinese. And my passport says Nancy. And like my middle name is my Chinese name, which is Fong Xi. And I'm thinking like there's a lot of Chinese American kids who are born in the US who don't have a Chinese name, who don't know how to write their name in Chinese characters, but they're being asked to do so because they see us as Chinese. But then like that doesn't matter. For example, if we try to go back to China like illegally or something, and like we were at the border with our American passports, like even though they could like treat us like without even thinking about it as if we're Chinese and talk to us like, oh, write out your name, it wouldn't count for shit if we didn't have that Chinese passport because we still couldn't get in. It's weird. It's like even those immigration officers, like they like see you as Chinese, but like they can't at the same time.
Yeah, I think your story really points out how fickle and slippery this question is. And that customs, ugh, that customs official like anecdote you're telling me is so real. Because for the last couple of years now, I've had to go through like the US passport line in Japan. And there, I mean, I'm half Japanese, so I look half Japanese, which is to say, like, I don't look fully ethnically Japanese. So people don't speak to me in Japanese when they get there, but they're, or when I get there to the customs officials like booth. But I have this like weird inclination to immediately very forcibly, like before he can say anything or she can say anything, to like talk to them in Japanese, and not just talk to them in Japanese, but like talk to them in like the rough ass dialect of my hometown, to be like, I'm really from here. Like this, I'm really from here.
Oh my God.
Which is so weird and bizarre. But yeah, I feel you on all those fronts.
That's so funny. My family's part of China is like in the Northeast, which is basically like the equivalent of the South in the US. We have a very strong dialect and slash accent, and it's has like negative of a connotation and like the same connotations as a Southern twang basically here. And my like rural accent is really, really intense. So I was like, I only know how to speak Chinese that way. I don't even know how to speak like an educated person apparently, because I was like speaking Chinese when I was trying to buy some sweet potatoes off of like farmer's market or whatever. And like literally the farmer like selling the sweet potatoes, like heard me speaking, and she was like, so uneducated. And that was like after I got my master's and shit. I was like, dang, I really fit in here, don't I? But at the same time, like, not Chinese.
Yeah, that's so funny that that woman said that to you. Like just to your face, like not even under her breath.
It was like under her breath. Like, it was like, I'm so uneducated, but I know that I forget like or mispronounce basic words all the time. Mm. So it's probably something like that, but at least my accent works.
Yeah, at least she places you within like her mental understanding of where people are in. If I could recommend a book to you, I'm sure you have so many books to read, but I just read this book called If I Had Your Face by Frances Cha. And she's like a former CNN correspondent from Seoul. And it's a book that is like multi-perspective and takes place in Seoul. And it's sort of about like multiple kinds of femininity and like the expectations of beauty in Korea, plastic surgery, like et cetera, et cetera. And as someone who's often back and forth between Asia, like I loved it. And I thought the way that she kind of breaks down the expectation of beauty in particular in South Korea was so fascinating. So I'd recommend that if you have time.
Ooh, I'm down.
I moved to this country and felt really shamed because everyone else in the first grade class could read chapter books and I was told that I couldn't. And so in a moment of revenge, I decided that I was going to be better at reading than everyone. And then that stuck for the rest of my life. But I was going to say, so the Frances Cha book is definitely one of the better books I've read this year. I read C. Pam Zhang's How Much of These Hills is Gold, which was just longlisted for the Man Booker, which is like a remix of the American Western told from a Chinese perspective. Very good. The writing is so sparse and weird. And at first I was like, I don't know if I'm into this. And then it just completely swept me away. Loved it. I reread Rowan Hisayu-Buchanan's first book, Harmless Like You, recently, and then read her new one, Starling Days. I like both of those. I don't know. What else? Minor Feelings, Kathy Park Hong. Did you read that?
No, it's on my list. I really want to read it.
I can't wait to hear what you think about it. She also has a Playboy Bunny anecdote.
Oh my God.
I almost like sent you a photo of the page as I read it, but then I was like, I'm sure she'll read it herself. I won't do it, but... Yeah.
Okay. I need to like read that like immediately. I'm like so glad that there's like a moment now where so many more Asian American authors are getting published. I feel like that wasn't the case a few years ago, but I might be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when Amy Tan was the one and only, and that's definitely not the case anymore. Although I will say, although like politically Amy Tan can be kind of cringy, at times those books, and I think especially the earlier ones were written for white audiences, I do respect the work that she did for Asian writers everywhere, Asian American writers, sorry, in America.
The ones that get famous first are always the ones that are more popular, and then that makes room for ones that come later that can be more like woke or have other viewpoints.
mm-hmm, and stuff, mm-hmm. Like Crazy Rich Asians made way for that Netflix like movie, the half of it, and like other things like that that are coming out.
It is, and I think that was something that I learned as I got older living in America. Was for a while, like, I really didn't understand the representation thing. And I realized that was because my like initial childhood was in Asia. And so everyone around me was Asian, and all the stuff I was reading and consuming and watching featured Asians. And so I was like, what do you mean there aren't enough Asian people like on screen? Like, it just won't be in English, but they're there. And then I realized, especially with Crazy Rich Asians, like, you know, certainly have my critiques of that movie, but it was such a joy to watch. And the theater that I watched in was in Boston's Chinatown. And it was like this communal experience of laughter and joy. And I realized that the representation of Asians in Asian American cinema, or Asian Americans in American cinema, is like really scant and small. So yeah, definitely loved the half of it. To All the Boys I've Loved Before, if that's what it's called. But you know, I'm here for all of it. I want to watch all of it. Are you going to watch Mulan?
Yeah, I think like my parents are going to really want to watch that. So we'll probably find a way to like get it somehow. But I don't know. What do you feel about it?
I don't feel any particular way about the movie. I feel very strongly that Gong Li is like one of the most beautiful women to walk the planet. And I'm I'm so excited to see her. I'm basically going to watch the movie to watch Gong Li be an evil witch.
Gong Li is so beautiful.
Her face is unreal.
She's also like 60 or 50.
Yeah, I know.
What the fuck? Asian skincare products or whatever has like been so big lately. And it's just like, what things are Americans consuming that Asians are creating that they're like, oh, that's great. That's like better than something that we have.
I mean, not to go full circle, but it's like that Sailor Moon moment where that girl was insisting that Sailor Moon was American because it was good. And now I can be like, no, I'm not going to use your shitty apricot scrub that's going to tear up my pores. I'm going to use this Korean and Japanese and Taiwanese and like all these Asian skincares, which are actually good for my skin. And you have to admit that it's from Asia and it's superior. Like, I mean, superior, maybe I shouldn't say superior, but it's a nice feeling to be able to be like, I can have this and I can be proud of where it's from.
That's so true. That is very much full circle.
Well, thanks for your time, Nancy. This was really fun.
Thank you for listening. And just a teaser for some future episodes, I will go into the Mulan and Hong Kong issue a bit more with my friend who is actually living in Hong Kong in a future episode. I also go into more detail about these private / public, I guess they're technically public schools, but you apply to them in middle school. I go into that into more detail with my friend who lives in New York City. We'll talk more about Asian American experiences. We'll also talk more about personal finance because a lot of y'all have been requesting more info on personal finance. So I think one of the next episodes coming up will be me and my friend who is an entrepreneur who will give y'all all of the personal finance tips and also how to buy a house. So there's a lot of things coming up. I'm excited. And let me know what else you guys would like to hear about. Feel free to email me or message me on one of the social media platforms about what you guys want to hear about next. And I'll make sure to get some interviews set up with people. But yeah, thank you again. Make sure to subscribe and rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And follow us on all the social stuff linked below. Check out the show notes. And I will see you guys next time. Bye.